Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is January 24th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we have a lot of talk about. I'm reminded of the quote from the Buddha who said, "Those who are awake live in a state of constant amazement." And certainly this week was a week of constant amazement. Upcoming events, let me just do some housekeeping first. April 24th, I'm going to be out in Portland speaking as part of the Ilahi Lecture Series. That's up on the blog under events. And we have are going to do a lunch with subscribers in Portland, Oregon. Also, upcoming C-Lane Advisory Financial Salons, one in Santa Monica on May 4th. And then later, we're going to do one in East Bay, San Francisco in May. Again, the 2012 annual wrap-up that we did in January, the first week of January, is up on the blog. It's quite beautiful, and Ben Lazzardi really outdid himself, and the Kristen Linton, the producer of the Solari Report, and so I would encourage you to take a look at that and use that as a tool this year. And then we have the transcript up for Secular Trends in the U.S. Equity Markets. Excellent presentation last week with Chuck Gibson, and we're also going to be doing a wrap-up kind of presentation, which we'll put in once we have that, probably early next month. Tonight, coming clean, the ins and outs of vaccine exemption with Alan. Alan had joined us in 2009, a great Solari Report when we were concerned about the swine flu vaccine, and now he's returned this evening, and we have a lot to talk about. We're going to be focused really on the exemption side. If you don't want to take a vaccine and there is a regulatory or legal issue pressing you to do so, how do you make sure you can access the exemptions? Our theme tonight is the global supermarket sweepstakes. Some of you may remember the American television show, and sometimes you'll see occasional revival or a rerun on cable TV. Supermarket sweepstakes, where teams compete within a supermarket they take a shopping cart and try to fill their shopping cart up with the most goods as possible before the time is out. And the winning team is the one that got the most valuable goods thrown into the cart in the allotted time. And right now, the international stage looks very much like a global supermarket sweepstakes. Perfect example is the Germans announced they're taking their gold out of France, and voila, we see gold attacking Mali, which just happens to have rich stores of gold mines. Now, there's no place over the last week where the supermarket sweepstakes were as evident as they were in Washington, D.C., where the Democrats were celebrating the fact that they are now going to be in control of the U.S. administration for the next phase of the financial coup d'etat. You almost felt like they felt really good about having outroved Karl Rove with serious help from Mr. Global. But the Democrats have rolled the Republicans, and they're feeling their oats as the inauguration took place earlier this week. It's important to understand the context of where we are. We had QE3 in September and then numerous bank settlements. And time has passed since 2006-2008, which means statute of limitations are being passed. And that means that many of the criminal and civil liabilities that occurred for many financial institutions through the financial coup d'etat have been extinguished. What that means is the next phase can begin. And that means the reengineering of enormous amounts of land and real estate that are in the foreclosure inventories or controlled through defaulted paper, mortgage paper held, including at FHA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, VA, big government control of those asset positions, as well as the large financial institutions and investors. So these are positions that have been picked up at sort of minimal cost, not to mention that the cost has been refunded in many cases through the bailouts. And that doesn't include the federal lands and all the mineral rights and lease rights that the federal government also owns. And so you're talking about a huge amount of land in play through equity positions, as well as land that is controlled or influenced by federal policies and regulations. in the process of closing out these liabilities, as we talked about in the wrap-up, this increases the chances that the slow burn can continue forward and decreases the chances that we'll get another repeat of 2008. We've bailed out the institutions, and then we've extinguished a lot of their criminal and civil liability, both as corporate entities and the individuals responsible. That means we're in a position to commit to a major inflation going forward, and all the signals out of the fiscal cliff and the renegotiations of the bailouts in Europe is a commitment to corporate earnings. And you see that in the headlines this week. We saw an announcement of record money moving into equity funds. That's a real signal of faith in corporate earnings going forward. And global unemployment hits an all-time high, and that's the system continuing to centralize wealth by squeezing labor and households. Now, the Democrats, as I said, are in position to pay back their large donors, both domestic and foreign. If you look at who helped engineer this election, it's going to, whether it's financing or operations, it was coming globally. And that means significant transfers of land and real estate interests are going to be part of that payback. And of course, it means once they are privatized, the federal budget and credit can be re-engineered to make sure that enormous profits on both improvements and the increased value of that land and real estate happen. It's important to understand that traditionally the Democrats have always represented the big real estate interests, particularly the urban interests, but those, as we know, those urban interests are showing much more interest in agriculture land and rural land. Not to mention the fact that now that we're switching to supplying oil and gas domestically, the fracking opportunities and oil and gas opportunities on federal lands are lands that can be picked up in this land rush. One of the biggest traditional investors in that group is the Vatican and the endowments and networks behind the Vatican. I've always considered him to be a Vatican man, and no one, you can see through the inauguration, is feeling their oats more than Biden. You almost question whether the Germans were involved. The Germans, of course, announced the move of their gold out of the U.S. Now, Germany has, in essence, been a vassal state, and we've had their gold since the ending of World War II. You almost wonder, what did German intelligence do to help the Democrats win the election? Is this payback? I suspect there's a payback in it. One of the last times we saw a very dirty and very big land grab of this nature, certainly nothing is on this scale, was in the late 70s and 80s when the federal agricultural programs and central banking policy was used to pump and dump the small farmers off their land in a move that was equally criminal as the one we're watching go down. And it was there was real trouble then with violence. It was the time when the farmers organized the militia groups who were very much, the propaganda was very much against them. But those were basically farmers whose land was being stolen with the help of the central banking policies and the federal programs. So as I said, the rural lands are more important in this play because of the value for agriculture as well as domestic oil and gas drilling. So I suspect that the big investors have had a big hand in making sure they want more gun control, because before you're going to go in for the great American land grab, it pays to have the population disarmed, particularly when an honest application of the RICO and financial fraud statutes would stop you dead in their tracks. So it's a lot easier for the global supermarket sweepstakes to proceed if the natives are helpless to assert the rule of law. Not disconnected to this was we see the SEC chief announcing they're going to push for the Dodd-Frank and Jobs Act rules. Don't underestimate the potential of crowdfunding as part of the Jobs Act to reinflate the real estate, and I suspect that's part of the plan. Money and markets. The top story in money and markets is the squabble over gun ownership. We have the White House having Biden now doing, it's no longer fireside chats, it's fireside hangouts, with Google support to market their initiative to promote, they're now calling it steps to reduce gun violence. You can see the The pushback has been strong and the words are softening on the Democratic side. Senator Feinstein has announced a proposed weapons ban today. The politician who got this right, interestingly enough, was former President Bill Clinton, who warned the major donors in a private session that the Democrats were really sort of over the line and ran significant political risks on what they were up to. Interestingly enough, if you look at the big donors who I suspect are either behind this or the kind of people who are behind this, they tend to hang out on Park Avenue. And in the cities, they have no idea what life is like in the middle of Arkansas or out in the middle of Montana. I'll never forget sitting at the Jockey Club in Washington, and I've told this story many times and quoted it in some of my articles, with Dick Ravitch, who was a big New York developer of the kind who rarely leaves Park Avenue and has no clue what life is like in the rural areas. And he said to me, as long as I get government subsidies, what do I care if people have education or jobs? You have 60 years of government subsidies, which have created a group that is unbelievably arrogant. They now have the bit in their mouth, and it's not surprising that they need Clinton to educate them on what life in Arkansas is like, because they really do not understand. We see numerous states around the country introducing laws that make it a state crime to try to enforce unconstitutional federal actions to compromise gun ownership within the state, and so the fight is on. The global sweepstakes are raising international tensions, and in many respects, the tensions globally are just as dangerous. All is not well in Euroland. We see the European Union proceeding with plans to institute a financial transaction tax in 11 Eurozone nations. This is a great trouble for England. The City of London depends tremendously on financial transactions, and so not surprisingly, we see David Cameron delivering a long-awaited speech saying I'll just give you the quote we put up on the blog. To try and shoehorn countries into a centralized political union would be a great mistake for Europe, and Britain won't be a part of it. Can you imagine Britain coming out against centralization of political and economic power? It's very interesting to see how things are coming out. There have been tremendous squabbles in Europe going back and forth over pedophilia scandals, mud being thrown all over Britain and now at the Germans last week. And you'll probably see more headlines and percolation about that. But that's what happens when you get a fight of the magnitude of a financial transaction tax. So expect to see more mud being thrown. One of the greatest concerns internationally, of course, is the continuing dispute between China and Japan. We talked about it last week. Territorial dispute. The U.S. taking Japan's side earlier this week, and now Taiwan today claiming sovereignty over the disputed islands. So quite a lot. Nothing was more concerning, perhaps, than North Korea announcing that really a blunt threat directed at the United States over its missile and nuclear programs. Let me just quote the Koreans, quote, "We do not hide that a variety of satellites and long-range rockets will be launched by the DPRK one after another, and a nuclear test of higher level," the statement said, "will target against the U.S., the sworn enemy of the Korean people." This is a veiled allusion to electromagnetic pulse and the explosion of a nuclear weapon in the upper atmosphere, which is something that can scare a lot of people because of the potential of what it could do to the electrical and the power grid in this country. So something of real concern, and just another step in the increases in the politics in Asia. The GOP has suspended the debt ceiling through May. And so now I have to take back my prediction that the Ides of March were going to be particularly tense. So the tension has been pushed out after corporate and individual taxes are due. But the spending cuts are going to still come down beginning in March. So the Ides of March, we're not completely out of it. But the debt ceiling limit has been pushed out. Hillary Clinton showed up on Capitol Hill to try and explain why the security and military forces never bothered to show up in Benghazi. We put a little clip from what was 3 hours of testimony up on the blog. Senator McCain basically called her a liar, and that's the section we put up. For many years, Sam Smith and other journalists kept a death watch of all the people in and around the Clintons who died in mysterious ways. It got to be a very long list. You can still find it on Sam's website. Whatever happened in Benghazi, and I don't think we know the truth, I'm sure it's going to be as ugly as many of the stories on that death watch lists were, and as mysterious. But it's a small reminder that life in the global supermarket sweepstakes can be a violent and an ugly one. Our hero this week is somebody who's made it a life work to protect us against that violence, and that's Sheriff Richard Mack of Arizona. Sheriff Mack is the former sheriff of Grand County, Arizona, a two-time candidate for the U.S. Congress. During his tenure as Sheriff, Mack received national attention by initiating an ultimately successful lawsuit, Mack versus the United States, joined by several other sheriffs, which questioned successfully the constitutionality of provisions of the Brady Act. Sheriff Mack has been organizing sheriffs to assert that they will protect constitutional rights on any effort by the federal government to violate the Second Amendment. It's a very courageous and important thing that he's doing. If you haven't heard our Salary Report with Sheriff Mack or gotten a hold of any of his books, he's someone I recommend to you strongly, someone we admire tremendously. That was a great Salary Report. Ask Catherine. First question, we had someone ask the question, what does it mean to us that the World Gold Council has now come out stating that the Chinese are going to back their currency with gold? First, let me address that. The World Gold Council was part of commissioning a study, and in the study, it was posted up on the blog several weeks ago. The authors of that study stated that they felt that the Chinese were going to move towards greater support of their currency with gold. But I think there are many degrees of separation between that and saying that the World Gold Council has come out saying that China's going to back its currency with gold, unless they've done something that I just have missed in the last couple of days. Some of the more aggressive pumpers of precious metals have been, I think, over marketing the nature of that study and what it really says. I would say that what I've been saying on the Salary Report since 2008, and certainly to one and all since about 2000, is that I believe that gold is moving to a much more visible center place in terms of reorganizing the global currencies. So I don't see China's increasing stores of gold and the importance of gold for the different multinational settlements behind the scenes at an institutional level to be anything, you know, other than in line with what our expectations have been here on the Salary Report for many years. I just think it's the next step. We're certainly seeing tremendous tightness in the gold market. I talked earlier about the German-France-Mali dance. And there are legitimate reports of tightness, particularly in the silver market. They all speak to the sort of growing importance of gold. At the same time, if you look at gold prices, we've been in a consolidation for the last 16 months. For throughout this primary trend up over the last 12 years, we have seen, this is the third sort of major consolidation we're in. The first one lasted 16 and a half months. The second 17 and a half months. We've been in this one since 2011. It's been 16 and a half months. So as we described in the Precious Metals Market Report, this next 6 months is a very important test of the real primary trend in gold and silver. And if you look at sort of the dance around gold and silver in the global supermarket sweepstakes, clearly they're very, very important. Now, let's see if the primary trend reasserts itself, because I think it has to be proven out. And the prices still don't prove the sort of over enthusiasm of those who are promoting this World Council sponsored study. So let's see what happens with prices over the next 6 months. We see, as I said, a serious commitment to reinflation. and that should be supportive of the primary trend up in gold and silver. Another question leading right into our interview. Dear Catherine, where did this obsession from vaccines come? Everywhere I go, there are convenient vaccination stations at the pharmacy, at the drugstore, and even at our local grocery store. Sometimes I feel very wrong here. I'm very interested in, as you call it, the backstory here. Did they really change our genetic code? Wow, this makes me afraid for my children. How can we legally and medically protect ourselves? Looking forward to tonight's call. Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight you to someone who's been on the Solari Report before, Alan Phillips, an attorney from North Carolina who has written the definitive book on vaccines exemptions and is the leading attorney in this country on vaccine exemptions, has a national practice for helping people with federal law. We'll talk more about that with Alan. Alan joined us on the Solari Report in 2009, when I was exceptionally concerned about helping our subscribers assert their religious or other exemptions to efforts to mandate the swine flu vaccine, which I was concerned was very dangerous. And we saw a real effort at that time to try and change state laws to simply mandate the swine flu vaccination. There was a tremendous groundswell against the swine flu vaccination, and that literally stopped it dead in its tracks, I think, in no small part thanks to the healthcare workers who many of whom said, I'm not going to take the vaccination, and I'm not going to give the vaccination. Now, what happened, and in response to this wonderful question from one of our subscribers, what happened is we saw the same thing happen on vaccinations that we saw, we're watching on the push for quote-unquote gun control, which is a real pushback from people knowledgeable about the topic and a conversion of an effort to mandate to a conversion to sell, sell, sell. And what you've seen since then is a tremendous effort to market and push and regulate for more vaccinations. And it was one of the reasons that I very much was appreciative that Alan could come back and join us this evening, because we've seen a really broad effort, not just to encourage, but to use regulation and workplace rule to force greater vaccination. And so for those of us who are insistent that we're not going to be vaccinated, or we're not going to allow our children to be vaccinated or over vaccinated, whatever your policies are, it's very, very important that you understand what your rights are and you know how to exercise exemptions. And if you're having any difficulty doing so, to know how to get expert help to do it. And so with no more introduction, Alan, are you with us? Well, thank you very much for joining us. I know how busy you are. And speaking of how busy you are, I would like to start this evening by you explaining to our listeners tonight, many of whom were not with us in 2009, how it was that you became so interested in vaccines and literally went from being an attorney in private practice dealing with business and other matters to somebody who's now the leading expert on vaccine exemption.
Well, actually, Catherine, my professional background is in music and technical writing. If you would have told me as a young adult that one day I would be an attorney or I'd be involved in legislative activism, I probably would have been on the ground laughing. No, seriously, it was the farthest thing from my mind. When my now 19-year-old son was born, a friend of mine told me that another friend of hers had a child who had been permanently disabled by a vaccine. I had never heard of such a thing. And so I went to the library and I found a wonderful book. I still think it's one of the best books to start with for people new to the issue, by Neil Miller, called Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? And it's short. You can read it in maybe half an hour, but it's just meticulously referenced, mostly to published medical studies, and it really was an eye-opener for me. And I was in such shock. It was literally about 6 months before I could open my mouth and talk to anybody about it, and it's been difficult to find people to talk about outside my practice anyway. Ever since, although I have slowly but steadily gotten a little more emboldened, and I just go ahead and put it out there and tell people what I do. But anyway, I'm a so-called second career attorney, or maybe 32nd, depending on how you count. But I was moved to go to law school because of the vaccine issue, and I was for many years, I've been practicing law about 10 years now, and for a large part of that time I was building the exemption and waiver part of my practice and doing other family law and general practice matters, but I'm exclusively focused now on vaccine exemptions and waivers, and I do a lot of legislative activism, helping people with the more technical legal aspects of vaccine legislative issues. So that's really how I got into it, and I have just really never turned back since first looking into it. And I've been looking into the issue. It's an ongoing research project as a parent and citizen, and I find that really the quickest and simplest way I can summarize what I have found and keep finding over the years on the issue, just generally the larger vaccine controversy, is the deeper I dig, the messier it gets. But that's kind of it. And when I started working with exemptions and waivers, I was quite naive, it turns out, about what that really encompassed. Again, it sort of depends on how you count, but I've discovered and worked with people in well over a dozen different exemption and waiver contexts or subcontexts. For me, anytime different laws involved, I consider it a separate category. So by that definition, there's, 12, 15 or more different areas. We're all familiar with schools, for example, and school vaccine requirements and exemption issues, but there are many subcategories there. There's public schools, private schools, homeschooling, military schools, colleges, a whole separate issue that comes up with nursing and med students, EMT students, when they have to do clinical rotations in local hospitals. The state exemption laws don't apply to the hospitals, and so there's different law involved there. So all of these different areas, immigration, foreign adoption is a subset of that. Military, there's military members, families, military contractors, can be different law involved in each of those different situations and even with different branches of the military. One area that's been emerging increasingly over recent years for me is what I refer to as vaccine custody disputes, the typical cases where parents agree not to vaccinate until they split up or get divorced, and one parent, usually the dad, not always, but usually it's dad who decides he's going to go pro-vaccine and try to make mom look like a fruitcake and grab custody. And there are unique legal issues in those matters that family law attorneys generally don't come up with or know about, because you have to approach it differently than other custody matters. So just it's just a topic. And then a huge one that I've been working with a lot in recent months then, healthcare workers, or you could generalize that to employees for hospitals around the country. And most of the time this has not been about state laws. It's just hospital policy where they mandate flu vaccines for the healthcare workers or as a condition of employment, get the flu shot or lose your job. And
Let me jump back, because when you and I spoke in 2009, when you joined us on the Solari Report, it's fair to say that from that time on, when the effort to sort of mandate the swine flu failed, my impression is there has been a sort of a wave of what I describe as trench warfare, an effort on a much more granular level to institute, whether it's rules in schools or rules in hospitals, rules in the military, to really, and also more state laws to push to get vaccination much more implemented. So with the backlash from the swine flu, there's really been a sort of new wave of trench warfare in this area. Is that a fair description?
I have seen a very aggressive, I don't know what to call it, let's just say push for vaccines on multiple levels, and I've been particularly aware of this since around the time of the pandemic and since then. And I'm not sure very many people I think there's a lot of people who are aware of, you know, one or more parts of this, but I don't think there's very many people really looking at kind of the overview, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were aspects to this that I'm not aware of either. But there's language in Obamacare, for example, that gives grants, federal grants to states to push vaccines, including things all the way to the level of going door-to-door, checking vaccine status or offering vaccines. The Department of Health and Human Services has an initiative called Healthy People 2020. Among their goals are vaccinating 90% of healthcare workers, but also vaccinating all employees in the U.S., not just healthcare workers. There's been a wave of changes in pediatric practice where pediatricians initially were increasingly using an American Academy of Pediatrics form called a refusal to vaccinate form, where they're requiring parents to sign a form that effectively says what a bad person you are for not vaccinating if their children are unvaccinated before they would treat the children, putting parents in a really awkward place because they're being told to sign something they disagree with if they want their child to be treated. They've gone a step further than that. Now I'm hearing from people all around the country saying that pediatricians are just flat out refusing to see any unvaccinated child.
Right. There have been many reports about that this year.
Yeah. I mean, increasingly over the last several months. If the even a pediatrician in private practice, if they accept Medicaid and Medicare, is probably violating the parents' constitutional rights if the parents have a religious exemption. But just sort of flat out, whatever reason, if you're not vaccinated, you can't bring your kid here, raises some ethical and legal issues. There have been a rash of new laws passed around the country, and particularly the last couple of years, and there are pending bills in other states to restrict access to exemptions, in particular for school exemptions, kids in school. And some of these laws, in my opinion, are unconstitutional. But just as to clarify that, a law technically is not unconstitutional until a court says so. So state legislatures or the federal legislature, for that matter, can pass any law they get the votes for and have the governor sign or the president sign or whatever the procedure is. Ultimately, whether it's constitutional or not, because until someone later challenges it in court, it is technically deemed to be constitutional. So when I say unconstitutional, what I mean is I don't think they would hold up to a challenge in court.
Right. Now, what stunned me today was your description of several state laws which have basically taken the power away from the parents so that now a child, including a very young child, can consent without the parents' knowledge or permission. Maybe you could just describe that as well.
Sure. The most egregious example, I'm embarrassed to say, is right here in my own state of North Carolina. I stumbled on the existence of this law several months ago when one of the local school districts had a contest where they were giving away an iPad and a laptop computer for adolescents who would go out and get one or more of the three recommended vaccines. They weren't required by state law, DTaP, meningitis, and HPV vaccines. And discover that there's a law here in North Carolina that allows a child of any age, the very first two words of the law are the words, any minor, to consent to vaccines and other medical treatment without the parent's knowledge and consent. And to try to make a longer story short, that's just blatantly unconstitutional. Parents in the United States have a constitutional right and obligation to parent their children. And there's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says children cannot make medical decisions for themselves, that parents have to make those decisions, even older children. If they're still minors, parents have the authority and have the obligation to make those decisions. Now, obviously, there could be specific instances where a parent is adjudicated to be unfit, and then, of course, some other adult has to make decisions for that child. But the state cannot lawfully, cannot constitutionally take parental authority away from all parents in the state and give it to anybody else, not even another adult, let alone children who by legal and medical definitions both are not competent to make those decisions. This is very disturbing when that kind of law is on the books. It's just
now one of these states is California, is that correct?
Yes, they have a law that passed I think January 1st a year ago, or that took effect January a year ago, allowing 12-year-olds and up to consent to the HPV vaccine without parental knowledge and consent.
So if I live in California and I have a child who's 12 to 18, I better be aware of this and be prepared to educate my child to not consent if that's what is desired.
I think so. And I was reading about a court case recently where it was during the pandemic in 2009, I think, where they were giving the swine flu shots at school, and the parent had a form saying that she did not give consent. And for some reason, I'm sure just a mistake on somebody's part, the child ended up getting vaccinated anyway. I've heard other people suggest very common sense advice that if you know vaccines are being administered at your child's school and you don't want your child vaccinated, just keep your child home that day. That's the only way to really ensure that
right.
There are no mistakes. But it's particularly disturbing when a child of any age can do that, because how can you educate, you know, a second grader to say no to vaccines or to even put a child in the position of having to, you know, deal with that.
To say, right, they shouldn't even be in that position. Well, let's turn to exemptions and how we can learn to exercise our exemptions. And two of the areas I'd like to focus on, because as you said, there are 12 different categories with subcategories. And before we continue, I just want to point out that you have an excellent book, I have it, on vaccine exemptions. And it really is the definitive work in the area, and you can access it at your website, which we'll give it out at the end, and we link to it on the blog. So if this is an area where you're going to need to be exercising exemptions, this is absolutely sort of the definitive work in the area, and I would encourage you to get that book. But let's just focus on schools and healthcare workers. And maybe hospitals. And let's start with schools, Alan. If I have a child in school, and let's just assume public schools here, and whether it's state law or the school practice, they are requiring vaccinations, and I don't want my child to have a vaccination, what are my rights? What can I do?
Well, the first step is to see what the exemption laws in your state are, because the laws vary from state to state. The federal government, at least theoretically, does not have the authority to mandate vaccines for state residents, and that's why the laws are all at the state level for school enrollment, vaccine requirements, and the exemptions as well. And the wording of the law and the exemption options are just going to vary from state to state. But generally, there are three different types of exemptions. Medical exemptions, every state has medical. Religious exemptions, 48 states have one form or another of religious exemption, all but Mississippi and West Virginia. And then philosophical exemptions, and about 20 or so states have an exemption where you just don't have to explain yourself, you know, give some sort of medical religious explanation. You just, in effect, say no, thank you. Most of those are west of the Mississippi. There's maybe about three states in the east of the Mississippi that offer a philosophical exemption. But again, the procedure, the specific procedure is going to vary state to state. Some states have a form, some don't. Some with a religious exemption, you have to spell out your beliefs, and others you don't. You really just have to look at each state individually, the laws. I want to comment, if I may, on this, because you mentioned that you have a lot of listeners in California, and Oregon is looking at passing a law that looks like it would resemble what California has now, in that the law doesn't mention the word religion or religious. And a lot of people, I think, misinterpret that to mean that there's no religious exemption there. You have to look at the language, and there's a legal principle that is generally applicable, I suspect, in all states that, in effect, amounts to if a law is unambiguous, if it's clear by its plain language, English language meaning, it means exactly what it says, nothing more, nothing less. So if you have an option for an exemption and you don't have to explain the reason, you know, in California I think they use the phrase personal beliefs, that would certainly encompass any personal belief, whether it's religious or not. So people can still refuse, and it's my understanding the California Department of Health has confirmed this, and that's not just my personal opinion on that. But you have to look and see what the procedure is. Now, I have on my website, I have a page where I list links for every state to three other websites that post the state exemption laws. And the laws do change from time to time, but I think these are fairly reliable sources. And probably every state, or just about every state at this point in time, has a website where people, the general public, can go to search statutes and regulations. But I do encourage people, when you're looking at the law, to look at statutes and health department regulations, because sometimes the entire law and procedure will be just in the statutes. But I think probably more often than not, you really need to look at a combination of exemption statutes and health department regulations to get the whole story. What are the exemption options? What is the correct procedure? And the place to be particularly concerned is any situation where, with religious exemptions, that you have to state your beliefs. Because on the one hand, Catherine, what even with state exemption laws, what determines what does and doesn't qualify for a religious exemption ultimately is the First Amendment of the Constitution. And under the First Amendment, just about anybody who's not an atheist could potentially qualify for a vaccine religious exemption. And under federal civil rights law that applies to employees, there's even language that encompasses a narrow category of beliefs you could hold as an atheist that are protected religious beliefs. So in terms of who can qualify as a general starting point, for the most part, it's really broad. Now, there's a few states that still have antiquated laws that require you to be a member of an organized religion, and that's a little more complicated. Those are unconstitutional laws and arguably unenforceable as to the organized membership requirement. So there are ways you can deal with that issue. But as a general rule, it's really broad. Where it gets tricky, though, is with regard to what specific beliefs do and don't qualify. And in my experience, most people who approach this on their own, if they're in a situation where their beliefs are going to be scrutinized, and that is a separate question that can vary from state to state or context to context, most people will include things that can complicate or even undermine the right. It's just the way the law works in this area, it's a little bit tricky. Let me give you one classic example, because I kind of hate to say that as a general concept and just leave it floating out there. Many people, when they write a statement of their religious beliefs that are opposed to vaccines, want to bring in a discussion about vaccine safety or vaccine effectiveness. And when those kinds of issues are addressed in a situation where the beliefs get scrutinized, they almost always get rejected because those are issues that are considered to be medical or scientific issues and not religious, for one thing. And for another thing, as a legal technicality, you can argue, and I do, that vaccines legally are safe and effective. They would not have been, there's a legal presumption, let me be a little more precise, a legal presumption that vaccines are safe and effective. They would not have been licensed by the FDA if they weren't safe and effective. They would not have been mandated by state legislatures if they were not safe and effective. Now, I don't personally believe that for a second. My point here is about legal status. And for purposes of writing a statement of religious beliefs, that's the wrong place to address the issue. I'm not saying that if you disagree with these legal presumptions I'm positing that there's nothing we can do. It's about where you do it. We need to go back to the state legislatures and say, here's the information about vaccines you haven't seen or were misled about or didn't know or what have you, and get them to change the laws. And that will change the legal presumptions. But,
in the middle of trying to exercise an exemption, it's not the time to try and reinvent the law.
Exactly. And it's not the time to try to argue with people who aren't going to be able to hear you anyway that there's a problem with vaccines. The place to take the problem with vaccines issue is the legislatures, not in a vaccine religious exemption. And for the most part, I think not in the courts, but we'll have to see how some...
So it's very important before I try and exercise a religious exemption to understand what the boundaries, you know, are in that process within the state that I'm in. And it's very...
Find out what the procedure is in your state and clear, you know, make sure you're clear, first of all, that there is an option, a religious exemption option. But you need to see, you know, what the particular language of the law in your state is and what the procedure is. But as a general rule, in terms of the boundaries of what does and doesn't qualify, that's a federal First Amendment constitutional question. It's not an issue at the state level unless you're in one of the handful of states that have one of these laws where they still say you have to be a member of an organized religion. But those kinds of laws were challenged in at least 5 different states in state or federal court, and every time they were held to be unconstitutional. So the states that still have those kinds of laws, Oregon has one right now, South Carolina, there's probably a few others, those laws are pretty clearly unconstitutional because they've been held to be unconstitutional every time they've been challenged in the past. It's just that nobody's gotten around to challenging them in those in
every one of the states. Yeah. So let's. So within schools, we've talked about religious exemptions. What are the other exemptions that a parent could potentially exercise within a school context?
Well, medical exemptions are available everywhere. They're pretty difficult to qualify for. In some states, and this is true of medical and religious, this next point, in some states the state has authority to scrutinize the exemption, and in some states it doesn't. And it just depends on the specific wording in each state. So if you're in a state that can't challenge, scrutinize the exemption, but say for the medical, then if a doctor says, you know, I recommend this person or child not get the vaccine, then you're good to go, in terms of school exemptions anyway. But in many states, they can challenge the exemption. And let's face it, Catherine, everybody knows that a bureaucrat sitting in an office in the state capitol knows more about your child's health than your child's doctor. And obviously, I'm being facetious, but there are instances where a doctor recommends a child not get vaccinated, and the state says, no, we don't accept this doctor's opinion, and the child has to get vaccinated anyway. And it's just... these kinds of things I find rather disturbing, but it does happen. So,
Alan, what do you do if, because I've heard the parents say this before, if the school tells you, well, there's no such thing as an exemption, you can't exercise an exemption, what do you do?
Sometimes one of the simplest and least expensive ways out is to call the health department and see if you can get them involved. I had a situation here in North Carolina once where a client calls me and a junior high school principal tried to tell the mother that she had to be a member of an organized religion, and we don't have one of those kind of laws here in North Carolina. We have a real simple 2-sentence law, paraphrased, says if you have a sincerely held religious belief, you are exempt. And the second sentence says, write a statement of your beliefs, and that takes the place of the certificate of immunization that you would otherwise have to provide for school enrollment. So the principal was completely out to lunch, and I was prepared to get in as an attorney and write a letter and charge my client, you know, an appropriate attorney fee. And I don't remember in this instance how it happened, but the health department got involved, and they called the school and explained it to the principal, and this woman saved some money in what would have been a more difficult battle potentially getting me involved. So a lot of times when people have questions or concerns, I say it might depend on exactly what the issue is, but you might be able to clarify them with the health department. Because if an attorney makes an argument, the people on the other side can just hire their attorney to make a counter-argument.
Right.
If the health department says, no, there's a right here and here's how it works, they're probably going to not try to contest that. But there are certain other kinds of issues where you really do just have to pull an attorney into it. Like I have, I've had situations where people, where private schools say or believe that the exemption doesn't apply to them. And the answer to that question also varies from state to state depending on the wording of the laws. But that's an example of an issue where an attorney can get involved and explain, you know, here's the law and the proper interpretation. Or sometimes schools, as do the vast majority of hospitals that I've worked with, they think you have to have a member of the clergy be involved or what have you. And most of the time, that's not true according to the state laws for school exemptions. And when it does say that in the state law, it's arguably unenforceable because it's unconstitutional. So sometimes I've been able to work with people in those states and help them get the exemption even though they didn't qualify according to the word or letter of the law, because that part of the law is unconstitutional.
Okay, so let's turn to healthcare, because the reason you and I started talking again about doing the Saleri report is because there's a real push now to get healthcare workers vaccinated and to adopt through the workplace much more aggressive vaccination policies. So maybe if you could bring us down on what's been going on in hospitals and healthcare, and what is happening, and how exemptions can help doctors, lawyers, doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers.
It's my understanding, and I heard this from a hospital attorney, and I haven't yet had time to track it down and pinpoint it in writing in the law, but it's my understanding that, or not all of this, but Medicaid and Medicare, CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, is, first of all, this part I am clear about, is requiring hospitals to report staff immunization rates as of this year, I believe. And my understanding is they're going to be withholding eventually up to 2% of Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement from hospitals that don't have a 90% vaccination rate. Now, this is everybody. I've heard, of course, from nurses and doctors and therapists, but I've heard also from a hospital cook and the guy who does data entry in a building down the street that isn't even, you know, in any way remotely connected or associated with patients directly. Everybody is being required to get the flu vaccine in hospital setting. And they seem to be, hospital administrators, particularly not interested or receptive to having a conversation about the merits of the policy itself. And I think that's in large part because their hands are tied. It's a money issue, and they're not going to, out of some sort of idealistic position about vaccines, give up part of their Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements. So I think that's a lot of what's driving it, at least my understanding at this point. But I worked with healthcare workers back in 2010 and 2011, but this past fall, the issue just exploded. I have never had so much work in my life, frankly. I ended up working with about 150 healthcare workers in 26 states last fall and early winter, and had, because of that, a very interesting and I think unique exposure and experience, sort of a cross-section of the nation, if you will, on what's going on in this issue. And there were three or four things that really stood out to me, Catherine. First of all, and this was disturbing to me, is the vast majority of hospitals that I've had exposure to through my clients have implemented exemption policies, and specifically with regard to religious exemptions, unlawful policies. The vast majority of them have a policy requiring you to have a letter from a member of the clergy or a member of the clergy to sign their form or some involvement and to validate that you're a member of an organized religion that has tenets opposed to immunizations. And that's just blatantly unconstitutional in violation of federal civil rights law, the 1964 Federal Civil Rights Act, and the part of that called Title VII. It's Roman numeral VII. That deals with discrimination in the workplace. So I have been helping educate hospitals around the country about Title VII and the boundaries of the right to refuse vaccines for religious reasons in the workplace. This is an arena where, of course, they're coming from a position of doing anything and everything they can to maximize immunization rates. And if you, the employee, want to bother to go out and spend your time and money figuring out what your rights are and getting an attorney or whatever, then you can do that. But I am happy to say that it appears that many of these hospitals are changing, have been changing their policies. It's not clear in other instances whether they're just letting my client through and they're not going to change the policy for anyone else or not, although I suspect that's going on in some cases. But I've had, for the most part, broad agreement with hospital attorneys when they get involved, and the vast majority of my clients have been successful. The ones that are most difficult for me are ones who tried on their own first, get rejected, and then they come to me. Because almost everyone who does that has done the very first thing I tell my clients not to do when they come to me up front. So it is a classic example of one of those arenas where your beliefs are going to be scrutinized. They are going to look for a way to reject you. And many times I've had to write to hospital CEOs to try and get someone's attention. I've discovered that when you write to the CEOs, the information very quickly gets to the hospital attorney, and then things usually work out for the best.
But we have a question from a subscriber asking about universities and whether or not vaccinations are required for admission or enrollment, and what you do in those circumstances.
Yeah, most, if not all states now, require some vaccines for college students, just like they do for grade school. And as far as I know, any time a state mandates vaccines at either the grade school level or college level, they'll usually have very similar, if not the same, exemption options and procedures in both arenas. The place that gets tricky, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is, and the exception to this, is with healthcare curriculums where the students have to do clinical work in local hospitals. What the schools do is contract with local hospitals to provide vaccinated students. And the schools will tell the students, well, the state exemption is fine for the classroom, but it's not for the hospital, because the hospital is requiring these, you know, as a contractual condition and as a policy matter. It's not a state required vaccine, and therefore the state law doesn't apply. That's probably correct. But it turns out that the federal civil rights law we were just talking about that applies to employees has language that covers students doing clinical rotations in local hospitals. The language has to do with not only employees, but uses the word apprenticeship or people in training. And that's clearly what's going on when a nursing student, for example, is doing clinical rotations in a hospital as part of her nursing school curriculum. So the civil rights law provides an out, but I have never found a school, in terms of my clients, a school or a hospital that knows about this law. And so it's a situation where students need two things. They need a legally sound statement of beliefs, but they invariably, in my experience, they'll also need a letter from an attorney to the appropriate school administrator or other persons explaining to them that, yes, you're correct, there's probably not a state law right here, but there is a federal law right for the students to refuse vaccines. So a lot of my work in this area, employees and healthcare curriculum students, is about educating schools and hospitals about the federal law.
One of the another question is it true that schools are compensated by, they said, government or big pharma for the number of students that they achieve vaccinations for? So is there, in essence, a financial kickback?
I have heard information about this. I don't have a specific example off the top of my head. But I recall in recent years having seen information about school vaccination rates being tied to state and or federal funds. So I can only respond to that generally, that it's my impression that that has occurred in at least some instances, but that's as precise of an answer as I could give right now.
I'll tell you, my impression from talking to parents and healthcare practitioners all over the country is they have far more power to exercise exemptions that they know, and there's a great effort to kind of not let people know this is available, and they feel somewhat cornered as though they have to go along. And I think the thing that most impresses me, and there are many things that impress me about your work and your practice, Ellen, but that most impresses me is you've really made an effort with your book and all your research and practice to really teach people about the power that they have under the law to protect themselves from vaccinations if they don't want to take them. And so I you know, on behalf of all of us, I just want to say thank you and ask you again if you would walk through what's on your website, give us your URL and the name of your book, how to buy it. Just walk us through all the resources you make available so that those of us who are going to be in a position to need to exercise our exemptions can get a hold of this, and then explain whether or not and how you're available also to help.
I'd be delighted, Catherine. My primary website is vaccinerights.com, vaccinerights.com. I have a secondary website. It's linked on the homepage of vaccinerights.com, so you don't need to memorize the URL, but it's the Pandemic Response Project, and it's those three words, .com, pandemicresponseproject.com. But on the vaccinerights.com website, I have a lot of free information, introductory information about exemptions in all the main different categories I've mentioned. My ebook is there, and it's only available as an ebook. You can buy it online, or you can order it through the mail. Some people don't like to use a credit card over the internet, and so people can order it through the mail, and I'll give them. It's still the electronic book, but on a disc. My goal with the ebook is called The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, and I saw a lot of conflicting information on the internet, it's a sensitive comment here, and I just want to be really careful to state that I mean absolutely no disrespect for anyone, but I find that anti-vaccine websites, on the whole, not all, but on the whole, when they get into details about exemption and waiver rights and procedures, they end up with a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information, and I wanted to help clarify some of those points and to even take it deeper. And so that's why I wrote the ebook. The goal for the ebook is to give people the information they need to make informed vaccine exemption and waiver decisions, including such things as when do you need an attorney? You know, because sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. But it's sort of like I say to people, if you have to state your beliefs, that's a place to consider, especially if they can be scrutinized. That's a place to consider having an exemption, because if you put something together and put it out there and it has some sort of technical legal flaw to it, it's just really hard to unring that bell, really difficult to come back later.
Right. You're new at this and you're up against experts. So you better, yeah.
Depending on the situation. You know, some situations like some school exemptions, like I say, you just sign a form or check a box. You don't have to hire an attorney to figure out how to do that. You know, right. So... everybody doesn't need one, but anybody who wants to know more about the law in general, the ebook is a great resource for that. I had an instance recently, Catherine. I'll try to be real brief here because I'm going a little bit on a tangent, but it was such a mixed blessing. I got a call from somebody with ABC, and they put out an article nationally recently about some Indiana nurses who got fired, and I represented some of the nurses at that hospital. They made a statement in the article, though, that was really frustrating, and I'm sure it was accidental, but they were quoting me as having said that the law, this is the federal civil rights law for employees, that the law is so broad that it protects any sincerely held belief. And I specifically said as I do to all my clients, to the reporter or the journalist in this article, that the law does not protect any sincerely held religious belief. It's really, really broad in terms of who can potentially qualify. So I've got this national attention, national mention, and yet was misquoted, and so that was sort of a mixed bag for me. But as we've mentioned, there are many, many different areas where exemption and waiver issues come up, and the most important, I think, single piece of advice I give people generally is that if you are doing a religious exemption and you have to state your beliefs, that's the place to consider, one way or another, getting information about what does and doesn't qualify, because it's not always consistent with most people's common sense approach. And it's a self-serving thing to say, and I'll just acknowledge that conflict of interest right up front, because there, as far as I know, there isn't anybody else in the country doing what I do to the extent that I do it. A lot of attorneys who, to one degree or another, have exemption work as maybe sort of a sideline, or who help nurses in this situation as part of larger employment law, for example, but nobody who really focuses on it the way that I do. But it's good to work with an attorney if you've got to state your beliefs, is sort of the general rule of thumb there. The Pandemic Response Project website is something that came out of my realization during the swine flu pandemic that most states have laws that if the state declares an emergency and mandates an emergency vaccine, your routine immunization exemptions go out the window. So historically, we've always had, wherever we've had a right in a state for a philosophical or religious exemption, it's always been a qualified right. It's always been there only up to the point that the state says, oops, never mind. And I think most people don't realize that about routine exemptions. It's not an absolute right. And this is something, it's a whole other story, won't take time to try to get into, but there was a Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that was put out right after 9/11, riding that wave of fear from 9/11 that was successful in changing laws in states around the country, passing overreaching laws, giving the state excessive authority. And one part of that was laws throwing exemptions out the window, routine exemptions in during emergency times. So when there's an emergency is declared, the legal landscape changes. And the goal of the Pandemic Response Project is to change emergency health laws, primarily at the state level, and then secondarily to support and promote informed choice generally. And that's primarily a legislative agenda. There's a wonderful website. It's associated with the National Vaccine Information Center nonprofit organization. It's NVICAdvocacy.org, NVICAdvocacy.org. This is a website dedicated exclusively to vaccine legislative issues. You can go to the homepage and see a list of current pending bills that are either trying to add more vaccine requirements for kids in school or trying to pass exemptions. There have been several states, and there's a fast-growing trend that have either already passed laws or are trying now as we speak to pass laws restricting access to school exemptions, a wave over the last couple of years in particular. And many of them are, in my opinion, unconstitutional. These are unconstitutional restrictions. They're trying to combat what has been a slow but steadily rising exemption rates around the country as more and more people become aware of the vaccine issue and start looking for ways to opt out. So it's a real curious time, Catherine, because there is growing pressure on multiple levels to force and impose more vaccines at the same time that they're trying to restrict access to exemptions. And yet there's a growing awareness about the vaccine controversy and a growing number of people questioning vaccines and asking and looking for ways to opt out. I'm not sure how this is going to play out. It's very, very, very interesting because
the trench warfare is on in this area. Before you go, I just wanted to also mention that our choice for Let's Go to the Movies is a documentary that was published in 2011, which I watched when it first came out, called The Greater Good, and it's about childhood immunizations. And it tries to present sort of the pro-vaccine and anti-vaccine points of view. So it tries to give a balanced approach. And one of the things it does is it shows a series of different families who've literally three families who whose lives have been, as they describe, forever changed by vaccination. I would say it shows you how a vaccination that harms a child can literally destroy a family, including bankrupt them financially. And because it's in the midst of this balanced approach, I think it does a very good job of underscoring the risks of this and why it's worth taking the time and effort to really do the exemption process right if you have this concern, particularly with respect to your children. There's a some very good descriptions in The Greater Good of the incredible barrage of vaccinations that are now given to little children, and you know, just the extraordinary impact on their immune system. It's quite remarkable. So I recommend it to you, The Greater Good. Well, Alan, there's so much more we could talk. I can talk to you forever, but we've all gone over our time. I would, you know, one, I want to thank you, but two, I really want to encourage anyone, healthcare workers, parents, people who know people in that situation, to make sure to let everyone you can know about Alan's website, his books, his work, because they're extraordinary resources for winning at trench warfare in this area. And I suspect many of us are going to need this knowledge. And I think this knowledge will make us all more powerful, and make us more powerful, not just to protect ourselves and our family, but many other people that we love and care about. So, Alan, we will spread the word, and we will try and encourage everyone to access what you are doing and all the resources you provide. And from the bottom of my heart, I can't thank you enough. As I said on the blog, there's nothing like a great attorney when you need one.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine. It's truly been an honor to be with you and your listeners this evening. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, we wish you well. May you continue with our many blessings. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, coming up, we have John Rappaport has pre-recorded a recording, the Sandy Hook Mystery, really talking about how it is the media approaches events like this and why in America. As I said, fact is fiction and fiction is fact. We'll post it next Thursday. Then February 7th, wonderful Soleri Perot. It's our Coming Clean for February. Detox Power with Dr. Laura Thompson, who's my nutritionist and is John Rappaport's wife. He's the one who introduced me to her. Extraordinary, extraordinary nutritionist. What we're going to do is we're going to walk through every, just, you know, hundreds of, well, maybe not hundreds, but scores and scores of ways that people can detox naturally, the importance of it. And I call it Detox Powerful because it's amazing the power that detoxing can give you. So that one's I'm really looking forward to. And then on February 14th, back with the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. As I said, another month and we're going to be at the 17.5 month time horizon on the consolidation period. So we'll be coming into a very important and strategic point for gold and silver. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing what happens to the trend line between now and February 14th and discussing it with Franklin on February 14th. So until I'm with you again on February 7th, ladies and gentlemen, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.